Move him.
We're not talking about any ordinary prisoner, Hoffman. We're talking about evil on two legs.
Michael, why now?
You're hunting it, ain't you?
Yeah, you're hunting it all right, just like me.
You can't kill damnation, mister. You don't die like a man dies.
He waited 10 years. I knew this day would come. 10 years ago, he tried to kill Laurie Strode. Now he wants her daughter. Don't go to Haddonfield.
Boogeyman! Boogeyman! Daddy, don't go to Boogeyman!
You want another victim? Take me.
Oh, come on, Rachel! We're not alive! Don't pretend you can't be dead!
But leave those people in peace. Please.
Halloween 4, to me, is the second best in the whole series. It's only second to the original film for me. It is everything that a Halloween film should be, and it's everything that a Halloween film never was after that film. It is the perfect fall set, just Halloween, just nightmare. We get the return of Michael Myers, even though he was obviously burnt to death. He's fine. His shot out eyes are okay. He's stabbing mechanics. He's going after his niece, which is the only negative thing about the film that I could think of. But basically, after a decade of being in a coma following the events of Halloween 2, Myers wakes up just because somebody mentions that he has a niece, and he goes after her, and it is amazing. It is scary. It is fun. It brought Daniel Harris into the horror genre. It is one of the many holy grail horror films, in my opinion. And I actually saw Halloween 4 first. I saw it theatrically. I was a little kid. I should not have seen it at the age that I was. But I saw it, and it scared the living hell out of me. And it also made me just fall in love with the horror genre. A love that I called the love of my life. I love horror films and the genre more than I love anything. I mean, my kids are second to horror. Halloween 4 is definitely the cause of that. And it's the return of Michael Myers.
Hello, welcome back to Scream Addicts. I'm Jason Jenkins. Call me Jinx. That was Jerry Smith talking about Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers. Mr. Smith is the editor-in-chief of horror website Icons of Fright, has acted as a film critic for Fangoria, and has written for Blumhouse.com, Shock Till You Drop, and Delirium Magazine. Welcome, Mr. Smith.
How's it going, man?
Good, good. Thanks so much for being on the show and for choosing Halloween 4. Now, it's funny you mentioned that Halloween 4 was the first one of the series that you saw. I actually caught Halloween 5 first, which is a weird place to start, but as a result, I kind of love Halloween 5, even though I recognize its many flaws, and I went back and caught up with number 4 eventually, but I agree with you. I adore the movie, and I think it still holds up. You know, most of the movies in the Halloween franchise, like, I can admit that Halloween 5 is maybe not so great. You know, Halloween 6 is flawed in both of its cuts, but I love them both just because, you know, I grew up with those movies. But going back and revisiting Halloween 4 for this discussion, like, I don't watch it every year anyway. But, you know, it really holds up. It's a damn strong film.
Oh, definitely. I mean, Dwight Little did such a great job in that film. And you said you watch it, you know, once a year. I watch Halloween 4 or probably once a month.
Really?
And, my kids hate me for it. Quickly speaking on Halloween 5, that movie to me drives me nuts. Not because it's a bad movie, but because it is like about 60% terrifying. There are very few scenes in the Halloween franchise that are as scary as Jamie crawling up that laundry chute. It's 60% terrifying, and it's 40% just off the rails. So, I mean, you know what? I have a soft spot for Halloween 5 as well. But Halloween 4, yeah, man, it holds up. The only thing that just drives me absolutely crazy about Halloween 4 is the mask. I mean, it's just, for some reason, it just always reminds me of, like, Casper the Friendly Ghost. Like, I could never see past that, but, I mean, the movie itself is just, it's so good. So good.
The mask could be worse, though. It could have been Halloween 5s or Halloween 6s or any of the ones used in Halloween H2O or,
oh my lord,
God forbid, Halloween Resurrection. They couldn't even get a decent mask for Resurrection.
He looks like a gangster rapper in Resurrection for some reason. Like, it looks like he should be in ICP or something. Like, I'm always expecting Michael Myers to start like breakdancing in Resurrection for some reason.
I there's an entire show to be made just spilling my hate for Halloween Resurrection. The fact that we were so close to the franchise getting rebooted a half a decade later anyway, they couldn't let Laurie go out on a triumphant note like she did at the end of Halloween H2O. They had to kill her in sort of an unceremonious fashion at the beginning of Resurrection. And then, you know, insult to injury, it's just a terrible film.
Oh, it is. It's actually a movie that I saw theatrically.
Same here.
And I swore, and I pretty much made good on that swear, to never watch that film again. Like, I was just, you know what, I will never watch it again. And I watched it this year just to say, you know what, I'll give it a second chance. And no, I will never watch Halloween Resurrection again. It is the bane of my existence. I mean, it is worse than my first wife.
It is an awful movie. I was the villain of my movie theater, the one that I worked at back when it came out. We didn't get it, but a theater about 30 minutes away got it. And this is after a week of reading all of those articles that popped up on Fangoria.com talking the movie up and, you know, doing an interview with Rick Rosenthal. And here I am thinking, okay, if H2O was essentially meant to be an extension of those first two movies, it was a restart of the franchise. It was Halloween all over again. Then Rick Rosenthal coming in to direct the sequel to that is kind of perfect. And I love Halloween too. And then, so I talked the movie up, much like Fangoria talked the movie up to me. And I corralled a bunch of people from my theater and a handful of friends to go with me. And we were sitting in a sold out auditorium. And I could feel about 20 minutes in, everyone's heads in the dark in my group slowly turn toward me and just judge me. And me having to explain afterwards, I didn't want it to be bad. I thought it was going to be good. I'm sorry. And then I let them pick for like the next 5 times.
Yeah. But, you know. I was at Supercuts before the movie was out, about to get a haircut, and I was about 2 or 3 people away from my turn. And I picked up Entertainment Weekly or some magazine. And I was just skipping through it, you know, really excited for Resurrection to come out, I think, the next week. And there was like a small little blurb or interview with, I think it was Busta Rhymes. And they're like, well, what's going to happen in this movie? And the first thing he says is like, well, Laurie dies at the beginning. And I was just like, what? And I remember I left Supercuts without getting a haircut because I was just so mad that I just had to go home and just, I don't know, cry.
It was depressing. Like, it was as depressing.
Is.
Well, maybe not as depressing. It was still kind of depressing. But I remember catching Halloween 6 when I was in high school. And when Jamie is – see, I saw Halloween 5 first, and then I went back and watched Halloween 4. And then, of course, I eventually went back and caught up on all of those. But because I was the same age roughly as Jamie in those movies, like, she was my hero in those films. Mm-hmm. And so to grow up and be a teenager and catch Halloween 6 in theaters – hoping to finally get a resolution to who was the man in black, what happened to Jamie at the end of Halloween 5, what, you know, and then in 20 minutes, she's, you know, unceremoniously offed, you know, much like her poor mom is a few movies later, and that depressed the hell out of me. Like, it really kind of ruined my damn week because I love that character so much.
Oh, definitely. And I think, you know, the Halloween franchise is, I mean, I love it with a passion, but it's one that really angers me so much because out of most of the horror franchises, I think Halloween and the Halloween series, they do that a lot. They get you really attached to someone and they kind of have the assumption that Michael Myers is the only character that they should really focus on and, you know, pay respect, you know, give respect to. They do it with Rachel in 5. They do it with Jamie in 6. They do it with Laurie in Resurrection. And it's frustrating. It's very frustrating, especially after watching 4. I mean, 5's iffy, but I mean, Jamie's still adorable, but especially after watching Halloween 4 and the greatness that it is, and watching Jamie and Rachel have to fight tooth and nail to survive, then you watch 6 and it's just like, it's almost like she's just like another faceless victim. It sucks.
Yeah, totally. And plus, you know, I guess I have no problem with the fact that they're killed in a way, because, you know, horror movies should keep you kind of off balance, yeah. I think. And there should always be really high stakes there. And I mean, that certainly created that feeling that no one is safe. But I think it's just bad storytelling you pretty much covered it. The fact that these were set up as our heroes and then they're just so blindly cast aside in the immediate, you know, the immediately following films. It's just, it's such a bummer.
It really is. And, you know, what makes the horror genre so great to me, and I wrote an article about it a couple years ago, you know, it's a personal thing, but, you know, as a small child, I was, you know, the victim of a lot of sexual abuse by my stepfather. And my mom, who worked at a hospital as a nurse, got her back broken by him the same summer that this all started. And we lived next to like a theater that would show movies for pretty cheap. And out of fear that my stepfather would, you know, do something to me or end up killing me, my mom would give me enough money to stay in the theater from pretty much when I woke up until it was bedtime. So, and this was a time way before Columbine, you know, which kind of pretty much made the whole carding everybody, you know, a thing. So with just a note from my mom, I would go watch horror movies, you know, every day, pretty much whatever was showing. And so that's why I fell in love with the horror genre, is because I would watch these films and I would live vicariously through the Laurie Strodes, through the Jamie Lloyds, through the Andy Barclays. You know what I mean? Those were my stories that I was able to watch these people survive these awful predators that would come to prey on them, and they would, you know, they would win. And that's, I think that's why I really am always affected by getting to know a character in a film and living vicariously through them. And then they're just offed like it's nothing. And yeah, horror should keep you guessing. And yeah, horror should be, I mean, it should never be safe, in my opinion. But when you kill off a character like Jamie Lloyd after 4 or 5 and, you know, kill her off in 6, or you do it to Laurie Strode, who went through so much in the first film and H2O just to get killed like that, I think that's such a disrespect to your audience. And it's more than just keeping you guessing. I think it, like I said, I think it's a complete disrespect.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I felt the same way. Even, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the Friday the 13th franchise, but even the opening of Part 2, it's like, are you really going to take the final girl that, you know, we've sort of cheered on and been behind this entire time, and then just, you know, she's done within the first 5 or 10 minutes? I hate that.
Well, what's unfortunate about that is, I mean, 2, aside from that opening scene, is probably one of the strongest in that whole series. And it's like, Jason, like, we're supposed to believe that Jason, who has been living in the woods this entire time in a shack, feeding off of, I don't know, animals or whatever, would probably take a taxi and walk to wherever, you know, like, she would live just to kill her. It's ridiculous.
I agree. Now, going back to Halloween 4 for a second, you mentioned that it's kind of the perfect fall film, and rewatching the movie again, I mean, that opening credits sequence, man, like, it perfectly captures the feel of fall in the Midwest. You know, I live in Southern Ohio, and I always welcome this time of year with open arms. And, you know, all of those shots of the pumpkins and the dead leaves fluttering about and, you know, littered about on the wet streets and the orange sky and, you know, all of those, like, really simple Halloween decorations, you know, it feels real in a way that the previous and the following Halloween movies never really did, which were all shot, you know, has any Halloween film actually been shot in the Midwest?
Let me think. Rob Zombie's Halloween 2 was shot in Georgia, I believe. I think Georgia.
Okay. I guess I was wrong then, because I think his Halloween 2 probably feels the most authentically fall. You know, those dead trees and, you know, sort of everything drained of color. Like, that feels real to me. But all of the other movies were shot in what? Like Pasadena and Salt Lake City?
Yeah. And what, you know, I definitely agree with you. The opening of Halloween 4 with the title sequence and stuff, I mean, it gives you that feeling, and it's able to really establish that feeling and that tone that, you know, the film has. And as somebody who's lived in California all my life, like, I think I lived in Arizona for a summer to visit my mom. But, you know, I've been a California native all my life. The opening of Halloween 4 is everything that I had always wanted Halloween to be like where I lived, but it never was. You know, like, it's so... Like, I don't know if I would use the word beautiful, but I mean, Halloween 4, that opening, it's almost inviting and welcoming, you know, and it gives you that right before, I mean, you're put through, you know, just the terror of that film. I mean, it's great.
Yeah, I always kind of, if ever I watch the Halloween movies, I've gotten to the point where I pretty much only watch them, you know, during the fall. But, you know, if I ever catch them any other time, like on television or, you know, just randomly popping in a DVD, if it winds up being four, it immediately makes me sort of yearn for autumn, which lasts not very long at all, it seems. I wait all year for it, and then it's over with in a blink, it feels like. But Halloween 4, I think, does the best job in the franchise. Zombies, second film aside, for actually capturing the feel of the season.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think my go-to now is, you know, God, apologies to the series. And I will always watch the Halloween franchise, you know, in October without fail. But my go-to used to be Carpenter's original movie on Trick or Treat or Halloween Night. And now it's actually, it's Doherty's Trick or Treat, because that, I think, nails everything that Halloween is in the Midwest, you know.
Oh, most definitely. I think Trick or Treat nails what Halloween is to everybody. I mean, what film can you think of off the top of your head that just gives you the overall aesthetic and just feeling of Halloween more than Trick or Treat? I mean, Carpenter's Halloween is my favorite film of all time, and in my opinion, it's the greatest movie ever made. I mean, Citizen Kane, Ben-Hur, I mean, they're thrown out the window. Like, it's John Carpenter's Halloween. But Trick or Treat, to me, I think is the best film as far as making you feel Halloween, making you feel what it's about, you know, and just having that fun about it. You know, I loved trick-or-treating growing up. And then trick-or-treat, I mean, it kind of harkens back to that just, you know, like, carefree, fun, and just, you know, kind of film. And yeah, it's definitely kind of gory at times, you know, so obviously little ones probably should stay away from it. But I mean, my kids love it and I love it. And yeah, I agree with you. Trick or Treat, I think, should be everyone's go-to film to watch at Halloween.
You know, it is funny you mentioned that it's probably a little too gory for younger kids to watch. And yet at the same time, you know, I feel the same way now that I'm an adult. And yet, you know, I remember being 8 or 9 or 10 years old and actively seeking out movies like Halloween 5 and Halloween 4 and, you know, the Savini Night of the Living Dead and movies like that when I was a kid. And I got to imagine, you know, I think there are young kids who probably can't take that. But if you're a kid who's seeking that sort of thing out, then you're probably going to be okay.
You know, definitely.
When you watch it. I think Trick or Treat would be almost the perfect gateway movie into other horror films for a younger kid.
Oh, most definitely. And what you said kind of made me think of that music video that kind of was very popular for a few weeks this year. The Wolfie's Just Fine.
Did you see that? It was so good.
That music video, and, you know, it being about Friday 13th 5, that music video really captures that spirit of being a kid and, you know, wanting to sneak out and watch a horror film and watching it and it scaring the living hell out of you. It's great. And, I'm a father of three. My oldest is in high school and my younger kids are in elementary school. You know, watching horror films at a very early age for me, like 6 years old, 5, 6, And for some reason, I mean, even though it was a really horrible time in my life, like I said, but being that young, I kind of wonder why the theater, you know, attendants let me watch those films. But my kids, my little ones, they are just absolutely in love with the horror genre. I have to tell them no on certain films. Like, they want to watch everything, and I have to be the ones like, you know what, you could watch this, but no on this. Yeah, you could watch Ghoulies 2, or you could watch Trick or Treat. But, I mean, my daughter, she's six, and I think it was this week, she walked up to me, and she's like, hey, Dad, this looks cool. Can I watch it? And I was thinking, like, yeah, sure, I'll probably let her watch whatever it is. And she handed me the DVD, and it was Martyrs. And I was like, no way.
I feel like I'm still not old enough to watch Martyrs sometimes.
Yeah, same here. I've watched it twice.
Same here.
And you know, I love it. I think it's one of the best horror films of all time, but it's just so overwhelmingly just brutal that it just sucks the soul out of you in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. I cut it on DVD for the first time. And then when I was lucky enough to work at a movie theater, we would sneak in after hours sometimes and patch into one of the digital projectors when we went all digital back in 2010. And I knocked out as many horror movies, classic and modern, as I could in that auditorium watching it on the big screen. And it's the weirdest thing. I could handle Martyrs. It still wrecked me the first time I saw it. But I invited a couple of friends to watch it with me after hours because I wanted to see it on a large screen. And it's the only movie that I've had to look away from on like a repeat viewing. The moment when the scissors are laid to her back and, you know, you hear the snipping and then she is eventually revealed. I actually started to get sick and I had to look away from the big reveal. And I can't imagine a child watching that movie.
Oh, definitely. Martyrs is nuts. And I remember when I first watched a Serbian film.
Still haven't seen it?
Yeah, don't. I watched it and I was like, you know what? I never want to watch this movie again. I can handle very, you know, transgressive, violent cinema, but I don't think this movie's worth anything. But I want to mess some people up and I want to have a really sick joke. So I'm going to ask all my friends if they want to go to my brother's house because he has a big screen and have pizza, you know, have pizza and beer and watch a movie. You know, having been the only one that had seen a Serbian film at that time. And I brought that movie over and I had never seen so many of my friends like just like completely legitimately mad at me as that night. my brother like he went missing like at the end of the movie and I was like, where is he? And he came out of the hallway and he goes, yeah, man, I just wanted to wake up my son and give him a hug after that movie. And I was like, what? it's an awful movie. But yeah, Halloween 4 is great.
Have you shown your kids Halloween 4?
Yes, they love it. They love it, love it, love it. They're big fans of the series, but they're very opinionated over it, like I am. My daughter, she still, to this day, once a week at least, even though I don't watch Halloween 5 a lot, will tell me, Dad, why did Halloween 5 have to have Tina? Like, my daughter hates the character of Tina probably more than anyone in the world, and that's saying a lot. But, yeah, they love Halloween 4 so much.
I think I'm one of a handful of people who actually really likes Tina.
Really?
Dude, I am a Tina fan. I will admit that freely, because I think she has something which is withheld from a lot of characters in the franchise, which is she has an actual arc. I mean, you do hate her. Like, she is vapid and annoying, and she's nails down a chalkboard, and you kind of hate her in the opening part of the movie. But when she has to, like, she steps up and becomes, you know, she becomes Rachel in a way. And she becomes a protector.
You know, that's a good point.
You know, by the time she finally goes out, like, I feel like it's an honest to God tragedy. And her death is really upsetting, or at least it was to me as a kid. I mean, it doesn't faze me now. All of these movies are completely memorized for me. But, you know, when she's stabbed and it almost cuts to her point of view and the trees are spinning above her, Yeah. You know, it's such a crazy moment. And I realize, you know, watching the movie as a kid, I mean, even as a kid, I hated her. But at that moment, like, I kind of loved her and felt bad that she went out that way because, you know, she was doing her best to protect Jamie. So,
yeah, you know what? That's a very good point. I've never thought about it like that. I'd like to go back and watch Halloween 5 and kind of look around, you know, and kind of like looked for that arc. I've always just had such an intense hatred for the character that I've just been like, nope, throw her away. But yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and, you know, speaking of Rachel, too, you know, I wonder if one of the reasons that, you know, Halloween 4 and Halloween 5 might resonate more with kids who view them, at least it did with me, and it sounded like it did with you, but the notion that we actually have a hero who is our age, you know, it's not like watching a teenager. I mean, when you're 10 years old or 9 years old, 8 years old, and you're watching a teenager, I mean, yeah, there's not even a decade's difference there, and yet it seems like the characters are so much older when you're watching, you know, the lives of teenagers spill out on screen, you know, even in horror movies. But watching a movie with somebody your own age going through the same thing is a completely different, you know, sort of feel. And I think Jamie is one of my own personal favorite heroines, I think, in any horror franchise period, because, you know, at the time she was a child and I was a child watching the movie. But even now as an adult and looking back on it, you know, the stakes are so much higher, I think, because you have the boogeyman chasing after a child.
Well, definitely that. And Jamie is one of the few characters in that series or any franchise, really, that just feels so close to home for any normal or just regular child, you know. As a kid, you know, I was picked on growing up, you know, because I didn't want to play sports, you know. In fourth grade, I was, you know, sent to the office for distributing a backpack full of Stephen King novels to my classmates.
Really?
You know, I wanted to read. I kind of stayed to myself. And, you know, I was picked on a lot. So right from the beginning, you meet Jamie and you have all these kids pick on her, you know, and I was never really close to my parents. So I kind of identified with feeling kind of out of, you know, you're just kind of out of it when it came to, you know, your parents and that kind of stuff. And for her to be, you know, adopted basically and all that stuff, it just felt, it almost felt like I was watching, you know, extension of myself. And I think even if you didn't go through that stuff, the character of Jamie in 4 and 5, and not so much in 6, obviously, but in 4 and 5, I think the character's so easy to identify with because she really is just every little kid, you know, who's, you know, picked on and who just wants to have fun, who wants to buy, you know, who's excited to buy their Halloween costume and go trick-or-treating and all of that stuff. And she's just given such a bad hand. I wrote an article about it a couple years ago for Icons about how Jamie Lloyd really never stood a chance. You know, as much as I love Rachel, and like you said with Tina, I think Rachel has a good arc too, because at the beginning of the film, she only cares about herself. She only cares about, you know, what she's doing and spending time with her boyfriend. But by the end of 4, you know, she's really focusing on taking care of Jamie. But the character of Jamie, she's one of my favorite horror characters of all time. And that's even with saying, I mean, I can't stand the fact that Carpenter drunkenly made the whole twist into, you know, where Laurie was Michael Myers' sister. I've never liked the family angle at all. I feel like it renders the series kind of really just problematic and just not as scary as a mental patient escaping, seeing a girl drop off a key and following her and trying to kill her and her friends. That's terrifying to me. But
yeah, exactly. And what exactly does Michael Myers want in Halloween 4? You know, in the first film, you're right, he's simply the boogeyman. And, you know, in the second, there's that whole thing where, you know, we discover that Laurie's his sister, and he's what? You know, is he trying to relive the crime in his youth by killing another sister? And if so, I mean, I guess that's fine. But jumping ahead in part six, you know, there's that whole crazy retcon where we find out that there's some sort of a cult business going on with him targeting his family. And then, you know, in Halloween H2O and Resurrection, he's back after Laurie. And, well, and, you know, plus, I mean, God, this is, I can't believe I'm about to say one tiny, teeny tiny positive thing about Halloween Resurrection here, but bear with me. After he kills Laurie in the opening of Resurrection, he goes back home and he starts killing random people again, you know, anyone crosses his path. And, you know, as bad as Resurrection is, it does return Michael to his boogeyman roots. You know, he's not targeting family anymore. He is the boogeyman again. But, you know, when we look at part four and then part five, you know, forgetting six's retcon, which didn't exist at this point, what in the hell is he doing?
I don't know. And the fact that, I mean, it almost seems like I'm, you know, like talking shit about Halloween 4, but I'm definitely not. It almost, I mean, it's laughable to me how he got shot in the eyes, but, you know, he wakes up when the ambulance drivers, you know, just mention that he has a niece, kills them, and he goes home to stalk her and try to kill her. It doesn't make sense to me. I mean, yeah, like you said, Six has the whole cult thing and the Curse of Thorn, but I've never understood it.
He's not the boogeyman in part four and five so much as he's just kind of... What?
Kind of like, dick.
He's kind of a dick with a knife who wants to be the only member of his family. That's just, that's weird. That's a weird motivation.
It really is, and it's kind of selfish. Like, Michael Myers, he's a dick.
Going to be the only Myers.
Right? Jesus.
Had he succeeded, would he start targeting people in the phone book who had the same last name like the Terminator? Sarah Myers? You know, it just, it's a bizarre thing, but.
Yeah. Mike Myers would definitely be one of those people.
But it is neat, you know, going back to Jamie for a second, you're right. Even before the boogeyman targets her for, you know, murder, I mean, the deck is so stacked against her. Like, you know, she seems so out of place where she's living. She's adopted. She lost her mom. She's bullied at school. I mean, there is that scene where the kids are racing around talking about her uncle being the boogeyman.
It
and they're screaming.
Cruel. That is one of the cruelest scenes I've ever seen, because it's like, oh, Jamie doesn't have a mom, she's dead. Like, I don't even remember kids my age being that screwed up and like cruel.
No. I mean, I dealt with bullies definitely growing up, but damn it, there was a line that wasn't crossed, and those kids in Halloween 4, they crossed that line. And you know, my God, later on they see her in her Halloween costume when she's with Rachel. And I think it's the fact that there's an adult nearby where they're immediately kind of like, oh, hey, cool costume. Do you want to trick or treat with us? If I were Jamie, I'd be like, fuck off.
Yeah, and you know that, like, for a second when they were trick or treating with her, they were probably whispering and like, your mom's dead. And, you know, it's only because Rachel's here that you're with us.
Oh, totally. Yeah. You know, it is funny, though, that scene where they're shouting boogeyman, boogeyman at her. It's kind of like a nice callback to Tommy being bullied in Halloween 1. And there are a lot of, I think, little nods to Halloween 1 sprinkled throughout. This feels almost, you know, it was 10 years after Carpenter's movie came out. And in many ways, this almost feels like H1O, you know, the 10th anniversary film that's kind of celebrating the franchise up until that point.
Oh, most definitely. And Rachel's friend driving them is supposed to be Lindsay grown up.
Yeah.
Like, that's great.
Which is, you know, it's kind of sad that they didn't do more with that. I mean, it's neat that she was in the car, and it's neat that they, you know, and dear God, we wouldn't want the poor girl to go through the same thing that she did as a kid. That would just be awful. But, you know, I wish they'd done a little more with Lindsay. But even down to the stuff like Myers coming back to Haddonfield and then retrieving a mask from the hardware store or the pharmacy, I guess, in this case. But, I love all of those callbacks to the original film, and it just makes the movie more fun for a fan.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that that's what one of the many reasons that I love Halloween 4 so much is that it is just that. It is a lot of fun. I mean, there are a lot of moments where you just have to kind of giggle. I mean, when all of, like, the, you know, the drunken redneck guys accidentally shoot, I forgot his name, shoot the guy in the bushes.
Oh, yeah. Not Ben Tramer.
No, he got it in two, poor guy. Justin Beam has a podcast, and, you know, he was writing that definitive book on Halloween for a while before.
I still want that book.
Oh my God. That's one of the many things in history, kind of like Rob Zombie doing a Manson movie, that I mourn about. I mourn the fact that we won't get that book. But on Justin Beam's podcast, he was like, I'm going to have someone from the Halloween franchise that doesn't talk about it a lot. And he and I were joking around that I should call in to the show as Drunk Ben Tramer. And like, I considered it for a little bit, but yeah, the redneck guy shooting the guy in the bush and discovering that it's not Lonnie, that was from the first movie, but it was whoever it was. I mean, that's funny. There are quite a few things that are funny. The kind of like bratty high school kids that make Loomis believe that he's going to get a ride, and then they just keep driving.
Oh yeah, what bastards!
That's what Four's just like filled with, just a whole bunch of bastards of all ages.
Well, same thing with it's kind of a callback to Ben Tramer again too. But that moment when Michael Myers is standing, you know, just near the bushes when Sheriff Meeker and Loomis find Rachel and Jamie and they usher them into the car, and then they see Myers standing nearby, and then there's another Myers, and then another. And you see the look on poor Loomis's face where he's like, dear God, how many do I have to contend with? And then it turns out, you know, the moment a gun is pulled, they're all Ben Tramers. You know, they're all guys under the mask.
See, that's a scene that I love because it's very frightening to me still. Like, it just the mood and everything that they were able to accomplish with that. That's scary, but that's another one of those giggle scenes. Like, all of those guys trying to play a trick, they all have balls until Loomis pulls out a gun, and the guy's like, and takes off the mask and runs. Yeah, definitely. God, that movie's good. I'm getting giddy talking about it right now.
And, you know, even beyond the fact that there are so many great callbacks, I mean, the movie sort of deftly catches us up with all of the previous entries in the franchise in that conversation at the very opening between the sanitarium guard and the paramedics, which is a great way to, you know, in doing that conversation, they hide so much exposition there so very well, and it's not clunky at all. And I don't think the movie is given credit for being as well written as it is for what's essentially considered to be a typical 80s slasher film. I mean, it has sharp dialogue. There are well-drawn characters, even down to the smallest roles, you know, like those medics and like the sanitarium guard and like Hoffman, you know, the sanitarium head. And, you know, even Reverend Jack Sayer. And can we talk for a second about Reverend Jackson P. Sayer? That guy rarely gets talked about. I want a comic book spinoff on that guy. I want that guy in the remake. Where is that fan fiction?
I've always felt the same thing, and I remember going back to that Justin Beam book that I'm getting emotional talking about not existing now. I interviewed Justin about it like a long time ago about the book because, you know, we thought it was going to happen, and he and I had like a long, long discussion about it. And I asked him, where would you like the series to go? And he said he would like a movie about the Reverend.
Oh, God, it'd be great.
And he's so great because, you know, he's on a mission, you know, and it's just like we never know what that mission is, but he's so passionate about it. And I think I really think people don't cherish that scene as much as it should be, because what we get in that scene is not only a fun character, but Justin and I agreed – it's one of the only scenes in the entire series where Loomis kind of lets his guard down for a little while.
Oh, totally.
It's great.
He finds a kindred spirit. It's the only time in the franchise. He's always the guy protecting somebody else, or he's not believed, you know, by everyone he's trying to warn. You know, he never has a connection with anybody. And yeah, with Reverend Jack, he, it's almost like a mirror being held up. Here's a guy who's probably chased his own boogeyman. As a matter of fact, I would love to see that Halloween movie. Show me a period piece set in the 60s or 70s with a younger Reverend Jack chasing his own Michael Myers.
Yeah, and a Spock mask. It was like Dr. Sulu or something.
Absolutely. I would watch the hell out of that.
I would too. I love that scene. And, like I said, you know, I giggle a lot at Halloween 4. And, you know, it has, in my opinion, and I love the first Halloween film. Like I said, it's my favorite film of all time. Halloween 4 has, in my opinion, the best scene in the entire series. And that is when Loomis sees Michael for the first time.
Oh, God, you know, yes.
And he begs him. He begs Michael not to go home. He begs Michael to take him instead. And that scene, I just, you know what? Like, I'm jealous that I didn't write that scene. You know, as a writer, I just look at that scene and I watch it and I just sit there in awe because it is such a great scene. Because Loomis turns around and there's a look in his eye that, you know what? It's happening again. It's going to happen again. I'm going to have to do this again. I don't want to. I'm going to offer myself as a sacrifice. And I don't think that scene gets enough love because it is the best scene in the series, in my opinion.
It's so great. And Pleasance, you know, God, what can you say about him? I mean, he was amazing every time out in that role, even in some of the lesser entries. But you're right, that scene is incredible, you know, because not only is he pleading with Michael, you know, he's trying in vain to talk Michael down. But you can tell every time he speaks and as he gets closer and closer, he realizes that it's futile, like it's not going to work. And he's sort of, as much as he's begging Michael, he's sort of resigning himself to the fact that he's going to have to go through everything again. And it's kind of heartbreaking in a way. Of course, you know, 30 seconds later, we get Loomis, the action hero, firing an automatic and diving away from an explosion, which is just weird. But, you know, it almost feels like that's probably the most Loomis ever was, ever since the first film, in that, you know, it almost, you can draw a line between that scene and that that other scene that only exists in the extended cut of Halloween 1, where he's standing in front of the guys at Smith's Grove begging them to put him in maximum security. And then basically saying, look, we can find somebody else. And he just, again, he resigns himself to it, knowing what a burden that's going to be when he just puts his hat on and says, I'll stay with him. And then he shuffles out sadly.
Yeah, and yeah, definitely. And that scene in Halloween 4, I think that's the moment where Loomis as a character realizes that at the end of the day, either, you know, one of them, whether it's himself or whether it's Michael, one of them are going to die because of this whole thing. I think Loomis knows that he's going to die trying to stop Michael. I think, and that's another reason why I love that scene so much. He begs Michael to take him, and he knows that he's going to die trying to stop Michael. And I think that's why he follows it up with just, God damn you, Michael, and just shoots at him, because he knows. He's aware that, you know what, if he doesn't get Michael right then, it's just going to start again and more people are going to die. And it's a sad, very emotional scene that a lot of people just, I think, like I said, they don't appreciate it for being such a great, emotional, well-written scene.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And, you know, not only is it a great performance from Pleasance, not only in that moment, but the entire film, but the entire movie is populated with really strong actors. Again, you know, as much as the movie is well written and it's not really given credit for it, the movie is very well cast and not really given credit for it either. I think it gets lost solely for the fact that it's, you know, at the midpoint in a long-running horror franchise. But, you know, Halloween 4 has great actors like, you know, Pleasance and Ellie Cornell and Danielle Harris. I mean, could they have found anybody better to play Jamie than that actress? I mean, what a find.
Yeah, definitely. I remember reading, and I don't know if it was true, that Melissa Joan Hart was up for that role. And I'm really glad that they went with Danielle Harris.
That would have been interesting. I got to imagine somewhere in an alternate universe where Justin Beam's book actually exists and we have that Manson miniseries written by Bret Easton Ellis and directed by Rob Zombie. I got to imagine there's a Halloween 4 with Melissa Joan Hart as Jamie Lloyd.
That's like Sabrina the Teenage Witch versus the Boogeyman.
But, would Danielle Harris be Sabrina the Teenage Witch in that universe, I wonder?
You know what? I could live with that. but yeah, I mean, the like you said, the cast is great. Bo Starr as Meekler. I mean, Sasha, oh man, what's his name?
I always have trouble for remembering, rather, too.
I always confuse Jensen. Him. Okay, cool. Sasha Jensen. See, because I always confuse him with the guy, Sasha, who played the kickboxer in the later movies.
Oh, yeah. Sasha, yeah. I don't know his last name. Right.
I almost said Gray, but we definitely know that's not who it is.
Not Van Damme.
Yeah, and Kathleen Kinmont, oh my lord. I mean...
Which she was, she had a moment there where she was totally like a scream queen, you know, in some of those 80s flicks between Halloween 4 and Bride of Reanimator. Like, but did she ever do anything like especially noteworthy in the genre after that or before that?
See, I don't think so. The only things that I remember her doing afterwards were a lot of like, you know, those action films that are also kind of softcore movies for like Cinemax or HBO. I remember her doing a good amount of those with Lorenzo Lamas, but
probably a Snake Eater sequel, something like that.
Yeah, I loved him as a teenager, don't get me wrong, but
no, hey, I grew up in the 90s. I remember Cinemax action movies.
Yes, they were great. But no, I don't think so. And I, you know what, to this day, I mean, even these days, I'd love to see her return to the genre and do something cool, because I think she's great in Halloween 4.
Yeah, no, she is very good. I mean, you kind of hate her, but it is a very good performance, and it would have been interesting to see what else she could do, especially considering that, you know, there is a range there between Halloween 4 and Bride of Reanimator where she is, you know, she's much more sympathetic.
Oh, definitely. And speaking of Kathleen Kinmont, I think that's another thing that Halloween 4 has that a lot of the other ones don't, is that kind of like quarrel and that kind of feud between her character and Rachel. I mean, it's like you said, it's a very well-written movie. I mean, the characters are really well-rounded. There's a lot of subplot kind of situations that a lot of other films in the series don't have.
Yeah, I agree. Even down to the smallest characters, like going back to Dr. Hoffman, who was played by Michael, is it Pataki, I believe?
Yeah.
You know, he's not in the movie for very long, and yet for, what is it, 2-3 scenes, something like that? And yet, with the dialogue that he's given and the performance that actor gives, you know the entire history between he and Loomis. You know exactly what it's been like, those two guys dealing with one another. You know, he has that, it's ice cold in a way, but that line where he says, my hope, you know, now that Michael is gone, is that Loomis will either move on, retire, or die. <You know? laughs> And even the scene with he and Loomis where, you know, Loomis has that great introduction in Halloween 4 where he sort of limps into frame on the cane and he confronts Hoffman and you see the scars which sort of, you know, deftly explain away his survival from Halloween 2. But, you know, when Hoffman starts to report to him the accident that happens, you know, or happened rather with Michael in the ambulance, and the way both actors play it, you know, Hoffman realizing that, dear God, have I been wrong all this time? And then Loomis, not even waiting for his sentence to be finished. He just, as soon as he hears there was an accident, he turns and immediately stalks away, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Man, such a good movie.
Yeah, I really do love it. And plus, you know, there's a little bit of weirdness in there, too. I mean, up until that point in the franchise, we had Halloween 1, Halloween 2, and then Halloween 3, which is completely unrelated. And I, you know, I can remember being a teenager defending that movie when nobody else would on message boards like horrormovies.com and places like that. And it feels like these days, you know, fandom has pretty much finally embraced Halloween 3. But the thing is that Halloween 3 is a solid movie if it's just Season of the Witch, but it's a terrible Halloween movie. I hate the fact that we have a television ad for John Carpenter's Halloween on a television screen in a bar in Halloween. It's just, I hate stuff like that.
Well, I mean, for Halloween 3, which is still early on in the franchise, being like the immortal classic, like how cocky do you get? Like, there are films that are 10 years old that don't have the balls to say stuff like that.
Yeah, and nobody should. Nobody should say that about themselves. You know,
immortal classic by the genius John Carpenter.
But we have, you know, taking Halloween 3 out of the equation, we just have 1 and 2, and there isn't really anything overtly supernatural happening in those movies aside from the fact that you can fill Myers full of lead and he keeps on coming. But even that's treated like, Yeah, he's the boogeyman, but we never see wounds heal up by themselves or anything like that, you know. But in this one, you know, during Jamie Lloyd's introduction, she sees the Smiths Grove ambulance, but it winds up only being a dream. But how did Jamie know about the ambulance at all? And what about her masked uncle? You know, like, how would she know what he looked like? And it's sort of the first sign that there's some sort of psychic bond between she and Michael, which is touched on throughout the film, and especially in the finale, and especially in Halloween 5. And, you know, Rob Zombie did something similar with his Laurie and Michael in Halloween 2, though that was sort of like this shared madness. But, you know, it felt like an interesting route for the franchise to take, and it would only go further and further, I think, during that, you know, down that supernatural road, especially once you get to Halloween 6 and the Cult of Thorn and all of that stuff. But I don't know, as a fan of the franchise and as a fan of the first Halloween, how do you feel about the introduction to the supernatural to that degree in the series?
Well, I mean, like I said, I've never liked the kind of twist, the family twist. I've never liked that. But with that being said, having come to terms with that, I love the little sprinkles of it in 4, and I like where they go with it in 5. My only problem with it is that they didn't expand on the ending of 4, because it's one of the greatest horror endings ever. I mean, and that is the beginning of Crazy Loomis, which is the Loomis that we see for the next 2 films.
And he is, my God, when it reaches a fever pitch in part 5, when he, I mean, my God, they couldn't have gone any further with whole Ahab thing and Loomis than him capturing Myers in a net and beating him with a plank of wood, screaming, Michael, you know, it's, he
well,
goes completely batshit.
Not only that, but he basically holds up Jamie to Michael. I was like, come here, dude, you know, like,
yeah,
like, how crazy do you get? But in 4, at the end, I mean, Jamie's standing there, you know, bloody with the scissors and the outfit, and Loomis just raises his gun ready to take her out. It's shocking.
He's like, I'm not doing this again.
He's like,
not
nope.
Again.
I just got rid of one of them. I'm shooting this kid.
You know, talking about alternate universes, I can imagine that somewhere out there is a Halloween 5 where Jamie was, well, not the boogeyman, the boogey girl? Is that a thing? Would she have been the villain in some of the – that would have been a very interesting route for them to take. But would they have kept her a little girl getting out and wreaking havoc, or would they have aged her up for the sequel? But I got to imagine that there is a cool story to tell there somewhere that they didn't take the opportunity to do it. But
see, I would have preferred them to take that route more than, I mean, like I said, Halloween 5 is like 60% terrifying to me, so I love it for that. But with everything that came after 4, I wish they would have just went that route instead of keeping Myers back, coming back and back. I think if you know, I think that where they should have went with 5 is maybe a good 10 years later, you know, where she was, you know, an adult by then, or almost an adult. And, you know, maybe surrounded by different people her age, and we don't quite know which one is Jamie, you know, like, it could have been a mystery, kind of like a 10 Little Indians kind of thing. You know, and I think that would have been a cool, cool way to take the series. But for some reason, you know, she killed, you know, she killed her foster mom. And no, she's just a little messed up in 5, and she can't talk. Like, it doesn't make sense to me, really.
Yeah. And, you know, I like the franchise, and I like that it continued on, and I there's enough enjoyment in, you know, those later entries for me. But at the same time, the fact that Halloween 4 ends with that POV shot of somebody stalking down the hallways, and it ending with somebody getting knifed to death, and then the reveal that it's a child. In that way, I think Halloween 4 could have been the perfect sort of franchise capper. There would have been, it would have been circular at that point. The way the franchise began is the way the same way that it ended. And, you know, I think there was a missed opportunity there to go ahead and just call it quits, you know?
Well, but I think that, you know, when money is involved, that's, I mean, obviously everyone's, you know, priority. But even, I mean, this is going to be a weird kind of like a comparison, but shows like J.J. Abrams' Felicity, which is weird to be, you know, talking about in like a Halloween conversation, but that show was always going to be that character's 4 years in college, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I think that some series, and especially in the BBC, where it seems like they don't care so much about money, but they care about ending the series where it should be ended.
Oh, totally.
I agree. I think Halloween 4 is the perfect way to wrap around to the first one and, you know, call it a day. You know, like there are so many different franchises to be started. Like, as a fan of the first film, as a fan of the second film, aside from the family thing, I love the third movie, even though, like you said, it's not a good Halloween movie. It's just a good movie. And the fourth one, there would have been no other film in the series that would come after that would have been as perfect to call it a day as Halloween 4.
Yeah, I agree. But we needed sequels. It was the 80s, after all.
Oh, definitely. And it came out in one of the best years as far as horror sequels ever.
Oh, no doubt. It was 88, right?
Yeah.
Which gave us – what else came out in 88? I remember that great – I think it was an issue of Horror Hound magazine a few years back when they had Nathan Thomas Milliner do that great illustration where it was all of the horror films that we had available to us in 1988. But I can't remember half of them. I know all of the movies, of course, but
– I'm pretty sure we had – what was it? Nightmare on Elm Street 5, I think. There was it Phantasm 2? You know, I think there was at least four or five or maybe even six good franchise sequels that year. Well, I don't mean good, like good in quality. I just mean good franchises. I mean, Nightmare on Elm Street 5 is kind of like, it's one that I shake my head at, you know, quite a bit, but it has its moments, I think.
You know, and with Halloween 4 being in the 80s, it is funny, as much as Halloween 2 sort of stepped it up with the gore and the inventive deaths, because at that point it was stuck in the middle of that slasher franchise that it helped create. You know, Halloween 4 definitely feels like an 80s slasher movie at times too. You know, thinking about, like, you know, even Kelly and Brady's deaths are not so much inspired by Carpenter or even the, you know, slightly more inventive kills of part two. They feel fully informed by the slasher movies of that time.
Oh, that film has so many. I mean, starting out with the ambulance people, you know, getting the thumb through the forehead.
Still painful. Still painful to watch that.
Oh, it is. Even, you know, being older and knowing the little trickery about it. You know, you get Kelly's shotgun through the stomach. You get necks being broken. I mean, at the end when Myers is on top of the truck, I mean, he reaches in and puts his hand through the guy's jaw, and you see like the gore and the, oh, it's disgusting, but it's great. Yeah, definitely. It's definitely an 80s slasher film.
Yeah, and they definitely amped up like the set pieces in the movie too from the previous films. You know, I'm thinking of you know, that entire final act just sort of doesn't let up. We start in the house with those deaths, and then we go up to the roof where Rachel and Jamie are escaping from Myers. And then from there we go to the school, and then from there we go to the truck. I mean, it just feels bigger than the previous movies in a way, but in a great way, not in a silly way, but it felt like a natural sort of progression for that franchise to go to without going too completely overblown.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, Alien to Aliens, or even more recently, The Collector to The Collection.
Oh, sure.
You know, it made everything bigger. It made everything not more exciting, because I love the first film, but, I mean, it's just a fun movie to sit through and just watch it for that kind of big feeling. I think everything is bigger in Halloween 4. And speaking of that truck moment for a second, you know, I'd hate myself if I didn't at least mention once the moment where Michael Myers' face just smacks right into the windshield. Like, I laugh so hard every time I see that because it's such a silly shot, but it's funny.
I've always wondered too, like the blonde hair on the mask.
Ooh, yeah.
And for the longest time, I think that I had believed, you know, there's that moment where Rachel comes out and she sort of hoses him down with the fire extinguisher. And so in my mind for the longest time, you know, having watched it as a kid and then growing up and, you know, occasionally revisiting the movie as a teen, you know, at that point I was discovering all sorts of horror movies, so I wasn't always revisiting the old favorites. But I had always thought that it was the extinguisher's fault. Like, it had, you know, hose down the hair for a moment, and maybe it just went away by the time he went outside and was on the truck or whatever. But no, if you watch it, no, it's just blonde hair on the Michael Myers mask. There really is no excuse for it whatsoever, and I can't believe that somebody didn't catch that or take care of it on set.
Well, it's like what they say in the making of on that awesome complete collection from Scream Factory. You know how they shot with a different mask for a while, and one of the original mask that they used, I think, for only one shot in the entire film, the face was kind of pink because, you know, it aged so much, the face was a different color. So we not only get the blonde hair throughout the film, but we get that one shot where Michael Myers' face is pink. I mean, it's you know, like, you know, I recently directed a short film and stuff, so I'm getting into directing. But as a director or as anyone on the crew, even watching dailies and stuff, how did they not come across that? It's weird to me.
It could have been worse. Could have been the mask from Halloween Resurrection.
Oh, my God. Or the CG mask from One Shot in H2O.
God, I never realized that was CG. I saw that movie three times in theaters. I watched it countless times on DVD. It wasn't until somebody pointed it out and I popped in the Blu-ray and I watched it. And I was like, son of a bitch. It's like it almost looks like clip art on top of his head in that moment. It's just awful.
My kids didn't believe me when I told them that, so I paused it and I kind of like did the fast forward thing where it's like it only fast forward one frame at a time, and I paused it right on that, and they were like, what? Like, even my son, who's only like 7, like he thought he was like, he was so convinced that somebody just painted over the movie. And I was like, well, basically they did, just with the computer. And yeah, he wasn't a fan at all.
Just, yeah, awful. But I mean, good God, I understand why. How did they even get to the point where they had that bulbous, almost cherub looking face in the first place? I remember seeing the very first trailer for Halloween H2O, when he walks up to the door and his face is in that circular window, and it's like he and Laurie face to face after all of these years again. And it cuts to her, and, you know, she's obviously terrified. And then it cuts to him. And even as a fan who was looking forward to that movie, I couldn't help but giggle a little bit at seeing that. And thank God they replaced it. But still, who saw that and said, yeah, we can shoot with that?
Well, in a time where, you know, the second half of World War Z could be completely reshot, or, you know, the end of Rogue One could be reshot, or, you know, most of the movie of Suicide Squad could be reshot, why couldn't they just go back and spend a little extra money and reshoot all of those scenes, you know? Like, it just seems like continuity would be more of a priority than just saving a buck or two.
And that wasn't above the Weinsteins at the time to go back and start tinkering with the movie after it had been shot. But
right? I mean, those guys are notorious for, like, wanting exactly what they want and kind of, you know, forcing their directors to do that.
So do you think if Halloween 4 had been made 10 years later, we would have gotten CG hair on him during the school sequence?
I do. Oh, my God, man. I also think if it was shot 10 years later, after the Jamie scene, there would have been, like, out of nowhere, Michael, like, just popping up in it, and the screen goes black.
Oh, but, totally.
I mean, it seems like every horror film these days, aside from the indie ones, you know, there's always that little jump scare. But yeah,
I agree. And, you know, it is weird looking back at Halloween 4 finally, you know, they don't really make slasher movies like that anymore. I haven't seen a slasher movie in recent memory that has managed to capture the feeling of a Halloween 4, which is, you know, not merely a slasher movie, you know, or a cut 'em up, but something that was really well crafted, really well made, really well cast, and yet feels very much of its time. It feels like at best these days we get throwbacks to the 80s or we get, you know, something brand new. And I'm completely fine with both. But, you know, man, watching Halloween 4 again this year, I was really struck by how much I miss movies of that era.
Well, that and, yeah, it was filmed in 88, and it kind of, I guess it kind of has the 80s kind of vibe a little bit, but for me, Halloween 4 has always been the film in the series that almost felt timeless. That and, I mean, it could be, I mean, you know, I'm in my late 30s now, but there has never been a point in my life where I go back and I watch Halloween 4 and I'm just like, oh, it just feels dated, because it never does to me. It always just feels fresh. It's always just as exciting as it was the first time I saw it. It's one of those films, you know, there's a lot of films that are like some of my favorite films that are still great, but they never give me the same kind of feeling. Halloween 4 has never once left me feeling like, it's good, but it's not as good as it used to be. It's always just as good, if not better. I mean, you know, hundreds of times into watching it, I mean, there are little things that I pick up that I, you know, for some reason or another, didn't, you know, pick up the million times I had seen it before.
Absolutely. And I can't think of a better way to end this episode than on that note.
Yeah, right.
I think we have just about reached our time. Jerry, where can folks find you online, and what do you have coming up that people should keep an eye out for? I know you mentioned having directed a film recently.
Yeah, as far as the film, I wrote and directed a short film called Love is Dead. I write for Icons of Fright. I write for Fangoria, you know, Blumhouse.com, Delirium magazine, and I love doing that. Horror is my life, but Love is Dead is the short film. It's very different than what someone might expect from me. It's kind of what I like to call an emotional horror short. It's not so much about the violence, but more about the power of words and how destructive they can be. It's basically about that part in any relationship, or most relationships, where people go from loving each other to hating each other. And it's very emotional. It's very mean. It's kind of a mean-spirited short. So, I mean, I can understand if people would hate it. But, yeah, that's coming out this year. We're trying to go for festivals, but there will definitely be an online kind of rollout for it.
Awesome. I can't wait to check it out. Are you on Twitter?
Yes, I am. Jerry is just okay, which sounds weird, but a long time ago when Twitter first started out, you know, I just thought a couple friends would follow me. So it was Jerry is awesome. But then when I started writing, you know, people thought I was arrogant. So it's Jerry is just okay.
All righty. Well, hey, thanks again so much for coming on and for choosing Halloween 4 to chat about. It's a movie that gets too little love, I think. I mean, everyone is a fan of the Halloween franchise, but we don't often shine the spotlight on 4, I don't think, or at least not often enough. So I appreciate your choosing it.
Oh, definitely. Thank you so much for having me. And I'm always, always excited to talk about Halloween 4.
Rock on. Okay, thanks so much. And thanks to all you listeners out there. As always, make certain to like, subscribe, share, use the comment section below. Maybe hit those Amazon links below to purchase Halloween 4. Remember, any purchase you make through the Amazon links on our site helps keep us going here. And we still have an exclusive deal for you through Audible. Sign up for a 30-day free trial and get 2 free books. Until next week, gang, thanks so much and have a great weekend.
Maybe nobody knows how to stop it.